Mormon Stories Podcast takes a ton of work and depends solely upon listener support. To keep this program alive, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org. Hello and welcome to another edition of Mormon Stories Podcast. I'm John Dillon, your host, and I'm very excited to have all of you with us today. And I'm also very excited to have with us a very special guest and a good friend. His name is Dan Witherspoon. Dan has been working hard in the world of Mormon studies for many, many years. He has a PhD in religion from the Claremont Graduate School. He also has a master's in religious studies from Arizona State University. He's a former editor of Sunstone Magazine, the director of the Sunstone Education Foundation. He did that for about 8 years. He's done a lot of cool things academically. He recently helped create the Eugene England Foundation website at eugeneengland.org. And most importantly, he's just a towering intellect. The guy's got a memory that I've almost never seen matched in my professional career. And the reason why I brought him on today is a couple of reasons. He's done some recent podcasts for us, which we're very grateful. Some of the best ones I think Mormon Stories has ever had. But also, I've had many people write in recently with Mormon Stories and request that I interview more people who have struggled with their faith but found a way to stay in the church and to have a positive relationship with the church, even when they know all the tough stuff. And that is a description that I think suits Dan very well. He's an active member of the LDS Church. He definitely, probably wouldn't qualify as an Orthodox or traditional believer in many ways. And, if there were sort of a short list of people who, might approximate what we would think of as kind of a stage five Fowler, James Fowler type Mormon. If any of you are familiar with the Stages of Faith podcast that we did a while back, Dan would definitely be on the short list of people who at least are aspiring to that. And we might be able to say are finding comfort in that realm. I should reference that we did interview Dan along with Tom Kimball for a three-part episode on the Stages of Faith, episodes 15 through 17 of Mormon Stories, early on in Mormon Stories. So, Dan Witherspoon, welcome to Mormon Stories Podcast.
Thanks so much, John. It's great to be here and this side of the microphone there. I've really enjoyed the interviews that I've been able to do. I appreciate the invitation to do those, and I'm gratified for the great comments that people have posted about it, and I'm enjoying the Mormon Stories Podcast community.
All right. Well, cool. Any amendments, corrections, additions, or subtractions from your biography?
I'm scared by the comment about my good memory because I'm sure I'll be fumbling and whatnot around. But no, you factually got it about right. So thanks.
Okay. Well, Dan, in typical Mormon Stories fashion, we're going to just take it through your life a little bit and your journey with Mormonism. There's a lot of people out there who are struggling to remain members of the church. There are all sorts of reasons why. So let's get a sense for your journey, starting with your early years, and then take it through your crisis of faith and how you emerged and how you make comfort and peace with it all now. So tell us about your early years with the church.
Well, I was born, as they say, under the covenant. My parents were both grad students at UC Berkeley at the time that they met and got married. So I was born in Oakland, California. And when I was about 3 years old, my dad began a teaching career at American River College in Sacramento, California. So my first, all the years I can remember from age three or four or whatever it was up until 11, I was in Sacramento, California, and felt like I, had the typical fully immersed Mormon childhood. Back then, besides your Sunday meetings that, there'd be a Sunday school in the morning and then you go back to sacrament meeting at night. But I was one of the kids that had primary on Wednesday and, so we'd head down to the church and it was sort of, Mormonism was a full immersion sort of game back there.
Right.
I don't recall any particular spiritual experiences, but, right from the kind of start of, you know, kindergarten and who knows how much earlier than that, and on through my years there, I kind of was a show off. I didn't realize at the time that I had a really quick mind or a way of expressing myself that maybe, you know, came easier to me or whatnot than other people. So church just became another area for me, just like school, where I could sort of shine. So I don't know, how much my Mormon experience was anything to have the Spirit talking to me, but I know I got a lot of ego strokes from primary teachers and Sunday school teachers and you know, parents in the ward, you know, oh, Sister Weatherspoon, your son is so smart, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
So I, you know, just kind of the typical kid who, you know, knew how to make an impression and kind of did that in his Mormonism as well as his schoolwork and things.
And you're talking about what years there?
Well, you know, my earliest memories of, you know, going to church in Sacramento up and through, you know, age 11 or, you know, through primary. So I remember, I was back in the days when, you know, the later stages of primary ages, 10, 11, and 12, you had those bandolos, those green felt things, and you know, you passed off your articles of faith, and I was a blazer and a trekker and a guide patrol and all that stuff. So I'm definitely remembering those years where there was a lot of achievement-oriented stuff. We also had, you know, speech contests, and, you know, they had the dance festivals and all that stuff. And so there was just all these different kinds of, you know, cultural things that went on in Mormonism, and I certainly, you know, took advantage of all those different things.
Okay. All right. So I guess in the teen years is maybe when people first have a real shot at some type of formative, life-changing spiritual experience. Did you have one before your teen years, and did you have one during your teen years?
Well, my parents divorced when I was 11, so my life was kind of shook up, you know, by that event. And my mother and my brother and my two sisters and I, we all moved down to San Diego. First, we were in Lemon Grove, California, and we're there for a couple of years. And then my grandmother died, and my grandfather was home alone in his house. And so my family, my mom and us kids, we all moved in with my grandfather in Chula Vista, California. So really, you know, Sacramento for 11 years. I have a couple of years there in Lemon Grove that were my sixth and seventh grade years. And then Chula Vista, you know, all the way from the middle of junior high on through high school were there. And I don't know that I had any, you know, great spiritual experiences there. I remember, you know, we were, you know, somewhat the minority when you're a Mormon in California, and, you know, it's not super rare, but there was that, you know, 15 or 20 of us that were in the high school or in the junior high. And so there was a certain amount of, I don't know, what do you get? Is it prestige the right word, the right way? But, you know, you're living a different standard. You're seeing things in a different way. You sort of, you know, you grab onto anything for identity formation. And so certainly my Mormonism was a big identity thing with me, and I wouldn't have dared think about smoking or drinking or doing anything that would, you know, fall out of line with Mormonism. So I was fully living it, I guess you would say, to that. And then finally for me, you know, sort of the experimentation with drinking and whatnot just sort of happened naturally as a junior in high school and then as a senior, and sort of that identity is, oh, I'm a Mormon, to just, you know, I sure like partying. I sure like hanging out with my friends, you know, just sort of took over. And I don't know, I just kind of fell into stuff. And I think it's partly the fact that Mormonism had been so easy for me, you know. I was getting strokes from external sources. I was the golden boy. I was the, you know, the young man that everyone wanted to be like. And so I never really had to work at it. And so when temptation really came along or these things, right, I wasn't strong enough. I hadn't really proven anything to anybody except that I was a smart guy who knew how to impress people. So,
okay. So the, back to the spiritual experiences question, you never had this transforming pinnacle kind of spiritual experience, that kind of told you this is the one true church kind of thing, or anything like that?
No, I wouldn't say
okay.
That I did.
Okay. But you had good positive experiences growing up.
Yeah.
And then you had sort of a prodigal period. Is that right?
Definitely. I guess it, you know, from a junior in high school, I did go on and go to BYU, and I went to BYU for my first semester and just straightened up. You know, I was away from friends and the things that I did there in San Diego, and, you know, confess all your stuff to the bishop of your student ward. And, you know, next thing I know, you know, I'll be turning 19 and I'm for sure going to go on a mission. And then, of course, you go home and see your friends again. Somehow the ideals just sort of, you know, fell by the wayside again for me, and I ended up being quite a, wayward sort of kid up until age 22, where we can get into kind of what started making the change. But yeah, I had about a 5 or 6 year period there where I was out of the church. Not that I didn't believe it, I just didn't want to live it. I didn't want to grow up. I didn't want to be a responsible person. I wanted to just kind of follow whatever seemed the most fun and sort of the easier paths. And so I wasn't really rebelling against the church in the sense that I didn't believe in it, but I just, I was just out of the church and not really active within it.
Okay. Now, we haven't talked about a mission yet, right?
Nope. My mission was quite late. I didn't go till I was just a few months shy of being 23.
Okay. Now, wait a minute. So you went to BYU and went home. So did you like keep partying at BYU? Did you drop out of BYU?
I did go for another year after that first semester before I did drop out. I was in the dorms that first semester. I actually started BYU in a January semester. So I was there from January through, you know, late April or May or whatever it was. Then I'm home for the summer and things kind of fall apart. And then when I go back, I'm with some friends from San Diego and we get in, you know, we're in the same apartment along with a few other guys. And so, you know, everyone in that group sort of knew that I would hold things loosely. I actually had a girlfriend from my San Diego ward who was there at BYU, and we kind of, you know, fed each other's worst impulses as far as, you know, going out and doing stuff. I became friends with members of one of the sports teams. I won't say which one. And, you know, a lot of those guys are non-LDS. And so I just ended up attending the parties and things like that. So there wasn't quite, there was certainly the honor code there, and I was certainly violating it. But I think the culture back then, this is the years that Jim McMahon is the quarterback and things, you know, the culture back then wasn't, you know, to really report everybody who was in violation of the honor code unless it was really flagrant or something. So I just kind of kept it quiet.
So you were partying at BYU?
Yeah, I was.
And how was your testimony during all this time?
I don't know that I thought much about my testimony at this time. You know, okay. I had to take the required, you know, different religion classes. And I felt some stirrings, I would suppose that. Well, I mean, I know all along I always felt I'm going to give this up someday. This is, you know, eventually I am going to grow up and I'm, you know, and I think in my heart of hearts, I knew that I would probably repent and, you know, get back on the straight and narrow and all that stuff. But I don't recall a whole lot of turmoil within my soul that I was acting one way and, you know, kind of, you know, attending my family home evening group at the apartment complex and maybe showing up, you know, enough times to church to not get on anybody's list. But I wasn't really actively participating. I'm sure I wasn't holding callings and things.
And were you a really good student? Were you a brainiac? Were you kind of an underachiever?
I was a little bit of an underachiever that first year because, again, just a lack of discipline. You know, high school was so easy for me that I thought college would be just exactly as easy. And then, you know, no one was really making you go to class. And so, you know, that idea, well, I'll read up on it or whatnot. And you kind of blow a lot when you don't attend the lectures and see what of the material that you're reading the professor was interested in. And so, you know, I got a lot of B's and things during my first year or so at BYU. And then, of course, after my mission and all that stuff, I was, you know, straight A student and that kind of stuff. But yeah, I was definitely just kind of a lost soul. Went to BYU because that's where Grandpa said he would pay. And, you know, I just, I don't know. I didn't have a lot of direction.
Okay. So how'd you go from underachiever to putting in your papers to the MTC?
Well, for anybody who's read things that I've written at Sunstone, this one event kind of really is, you know, really the ultimate best thing in my life. I was really floundering, really lost. You know, I'd basically crossed every line that whatever I would have said in my life, I'm not going to ever fall that far, you know, down the rabbit hole or whatever. I basically went there, and I was at a very, very black point when out of the blue, my uncle calls me. Now I'd known this uncle. He had been in Chula Vista with me. He and his family, I enjoyed them. I liked them and things like that. But I have no clue what possessed him, other than, you know, afterwards he and his wife told me that they just felt like compelled to do it. But they invited me to move in with them in Mapleton, Utah. So this is where how I ended up for a while in Mapleton. I was living in Provo, you know, even though I wasn't attending BYU at the time, I was living in Provo when they asked. And so I moved to Mapleton, and it just was like, here is my chance to break away from the different friends that I had, the different, you know, things that I would typically do on my weekends. And I guess just something within me just says, I knew all along that I needed to make this break, and I finally did. And so I lived with this family, George and Janie Wright and their kids, for that year, from like January of 81 till February of 82. And, you know, just somehow or other, slowly but surely, the love of this family, it's a family that laughs a lot. They go to church. They, you know, they're fully immersed in their Mormonism. And it just kind of worked its magic on me that I was, you know, whatever surliness and kind of, you know, negativity I sort of had just sort of got washed away in sort of the energy of this house. And so, you know, within a, you know, few weeks to a few months, I would start attending church, and then that would help me feel a little bit better about myself as I'm, you know, regrounding myself in things that I think are valuable and true and whatnot. And so finally it all, you know, things were going fantastically until June. You know, I'd gotten a job. I was actually attending the U of U at the time too. Then they went on a vacation to, I think, Lake Tahoe or something. The whole family was going to go, and they invited me to go, but I had a job, and so I really couldn't go. And so they leave, and it was just like the strangest thing. It's like, who knows if there's a cosmic, you know, web of interconnectedness or something. But my main friend who had influenced me, you know, in so many ways, you know, in the partying, you know, let's go to the clubs kind of way, calls me up out of the blue. They're gone for a week. And next thing I know, I'm spending 3 days back in my old world. And finally, at the end of that third day, as I'm driving home, and I have a pack of cigarettes still on the dashboard, and I'm remembering going up 1600 North in Mapleton towards the house that I was living at. And, you know, just the whole way home, I've been reflecting about how much happier I was, you know, just last week, that I'm feeling now after having, you know, retasted this world that I'd, you know, left behind 6 or 8 months earlier. And so anyway, I just took those cigarettes, and I can still almost like see them flying in my mind, you know, almost slow motion out into this orchard that I was passing on, just flung them out my window. And I remember the thought was, I'm better than these things. I'm better than the stuff that I've been doing. And from that day on, I didn't smoke again. I certainly still had to face the, you know, the real withdrawal and whatnot. But that was sort of a turning point for me, where it's like, okay, I'm now actively going to choose this path that makes me feel better than that path. So that was important to me. And then what really happened next was, I guess it would be a month or two later, because this was the end of June, Education Week rolled around, and my aunt talked me into going with her to BYU Education Week. And somehow or other, I can't remember, you know, why or whatever, we picked this one, but ended up one of the speakers there challenged everybody in there to read the Book of Mormon. You know, we hear that all the time in church and whatnot. But for whatever reason, I was ready to read the Book of Mormon. I, you know, certainly I could have told you a lot about the Book of Mormon just because I had, like you say, a good memory. And I, you know, I remembered all the stories and whatnot from when I was a kid. But I hadn't really, you know, read scripture in 5, 6, 7 years. So anyway, I'm reading this book and it just like, you know, right off the bat, I feel like I'm immersed in this really important, you know, moment in my life. And, you know, I'd say now that the book is screaming to me, I'm true. And, you know, you need to, you know, come to me and all this stuff. And I'm just recognizing that somehow or other, I just need to change my life for real. And then I get to the sections with Alma the Younger and the Sons of Mosiah. And, you know, whether those guys are fictional characters or real characters, for whatever reason, they worked on me. I just could identify, you know, they were the golden boys who had everything, who, you know, just every reason to be successful in leaders and whatnot, who decided to, you know, fight against the church, kick against the pricks, whatever you want to say. And only to turn around, you know, obviously they had an angel, and maybe you could interpret my aunt and uncle as my angel experience of, you know, coming along and, you know, straightening, you know, giving me at least an opportunity to reevaluate things. But for whatever reason, those guys in their life that said, you know, it's not too late to change, you know, you can still be a person of value. You can be a person of worth again. Somehow or other, that just really worked on me. So, I mean, I can't tell you, John, I probably paced the floor of my bedroom for 2 weeks before I, you know, even could get the humility to kneel down. And I imagine I kneeled down and, you know, just was going to start praying, you know, a half a dozen times, you know, over a course of a week or so before I'd actually, you know, open my mouth and just, you know, start to tell, you know, God that I'm lost, you know, and that I want to find myself again and stuff. So it's just a real battle. But finally, you know, I was able to do that. I was I didn't, you know, see angels, no visitation, no, you know, trumpets, you know, welcome home, sinner, you know, back to this thing. You know, I really felt just like whatever message was there is... I'm starting to hear a little echo there. Sorry about that. But whatever message I got, it felt like it was just like, you know, hey, you've got a lot of work to do, but let's get through it. You know, let's move ahead. And so somehow or other I did. Go ahead.
So this experience was not lights or anything, but it was a feeling. What was it?
Yeah, I mean, I really kind of expected it. You know, obviously, I'm just this great choice soul of God. And, you know, and here I pray again, he's going to really, you know, shine his, you know, love upon me. And I didn't feel unloved. I didn't feel like, I just felt like there, you know, it was a voice that says there's still more work to do. Stick with it. We'll get you through it, you know, kind of thing. So it wasn't born again, you know, immediately change of heart kind of thing. It was like, you know, hold my hand, talk to me a lot, try to remember me and, you know, the daily things that you do and we'll get there. So it was really kind of a strange thing. And then, you know, so this is, you know, I'm imagining.
Was this the first time something like that had happened or?
Well, again, I hadn't prayed, I'm sure, in 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
And so this is, you know, I certainly have this big, long initial prayer where really, honestly, I will tell you, as soon as I said, you know, addressed Heavenly Father or something, I think that first prayer, I just cried for a half an hour, you know, just sobbed at the state of my life, you know, and how bad I felt. But, you know, so, you know, you kind of get through that and you begin to, you know, start saying, I want to feel my way back and whatnot. And so I felt encouraged along that, but I can't say that it was anything other than like, keep at it, you know, kind of a feeling for me. So,
okay.
But so we're now probably, you know, end of August, early September. And, you know, so every day I'm praying, every day I'm doing more. I'm sure I've finished the Book of Mormon by now or something. And I seriously, this is one of those weird moments where I'm at the breakfast table And I had not thought of it. I had not even begun to think of it, but out of my mouth just came the words, I think I want to go on a mission. And my uncle, who, you know, I was living with, happened to be there. He was reading the paper, bowl of cereal. He goes, what? He goes, let's go talk about this. And so the next thing we know, we're running. Did I say he was the bishop? He was my bishop at the time, too. So he just goes, wow, let's go talk about stuff. And so, you know, we pick up our juice and our toast or whatever, and we walk down the hall to his office there at the house, his home office. So my uncle and I chatted for a while, and we kind of looked at the obstacles that might be in the way, and certainly some of my past behaviors kind of came up in his rule book or handbook of things that you need to kind of clear with the general authority. So we ended up getting an appointment with William Grant Bangeter up in the church office building, and he and I traveled up, and we met for about 20 minutes with Elder Bangeter, and during that conversation, he felt able to declare to me through spiritual discernment or whatever it was that he didn't feel like there was any obstacles that would prevent me from serving a mission, and basically cleared the way for me to put in my papers, which I did. And somewhere, you know, November or December, I received a mission call to Seattle, Washington, and I left in February. So
go ahead. Sorry, what type of questions do they ask in those interviews?
You know, honestly, the only one that I could remember him asking is, you know, after the sort of, you know, recount your sins that basically made you come here. And I guess this will give a clue as to the nature of at least some of that. He asked, he had wanted to make sure that I didn't have any children out there or something that I would be, that I needed to be supporting and that kind of thing. And so it was like, you know, are there any loose ends or any, you know, consequences from these things that are, you know, that would impede, you know, your being able to fully serve kind of thing. And then okay. He really did spend about 10 minutes, and it was very nice to say, you know, there are going to be times on your mission where you may not feel worthy to be out there because of, you know, some of these things and, you know, being an older missionary or whatnot, you may feel conspicuous and whatnot, but he just went on to testify that I was completely forgiven of these things and you know, don't let Satan get to me, that kind of stuff. Don't ever let him be, you know, discourage me. So it was a very positive experience. He became one of my favorite general authorities. You know, you pretty soon, you know, how you have the ones that you watch for and whatnot. So it was a good experience. So, you know, that whole Christmas was dominated by all the different things that you get, you know, get your overcoat and your Mr. Max suits and your
right.
Forward thrust shoes. Remember, did you have those shoes that kind of thrust your stride forward? Anyway, it was just funny. So, and then I, you know, went on my mission in February, and it was interesting. By waiting for extra years, I ended up in that window where you could only serve an 18-month mission. You know, there was that 2.5-3 year period where some people got to choose. You know, you can either go home after 18 months after being called for 2 years, or you know, the opposite end, the 18 months you could extend for 24. I was right in that middle of February 83 through August 84, where I had no choice. So I had an 18-month mission. I came home and basically started BYU. I applied.
Wait. Sorry. So any big life-changing spiritual experiences on your mission? You know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Visitations or?
No, I mean.
Undeniable, you know, coincidences or, you know, stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say at least a good half of my major wowie zowie moments with spiritual things happen on my mission. So you're right, we probably should slow down. I'll tell you the first one. Well, there was one very powerful experience in the MTC that I felt like kind of the veil was pulled back a little bit, and it kind of taught me some things about myself. Sort of, you know, you could sort of call it depth psychology kind of things that maybe you can just say that, you know, we all know deep down within ourselves. But somehow or other, it became very clear to me that there were certain patterns, you know, in my life and whatnot that I've had with me, you know, at least the spiritual experience there in the MTC said, you know, these have been with you for a long time, going back before this life kind of thing. So that was a pretty interesting experience there. But right out of the bat on my mission, probably my first 3 or 4 weeks there, I'm on splits with the zone leader in his area. And I don't know, for those who haven't gone on a mission, at least when you're going to spend a chunk of your day tracting, we called it harvesting on our mission. You know, the field is white already to harvest. So when you're about harvesting, a lot of times you would look at the map of the area and you would, you know, seek inspiration as to where you might want to go tracting. And I swear I had this little, this thing on there that says 207th place, you know, was this one little street on this map in this other guy's area that really kind of, you know, I felt like this real thing to it, but I'm a greenie and the guy, you know, it's his area and he has, you know, XYZ investigators that we're going to go see. And basically the whole day is planned. And so, and he had an idea of where he wanted to go tracking, who knows, you know, inspiration or just, you know, he's trying to knock out a quadrant or whatever reason. So I didn't really say anything. And so what happened that day was we ended up with everything falling through. You know, we tracked his area out without getting any lessons. And so you're done kind of earlier, you know, than you expect on that. And we go to try to visit this investigator. We drop by all these things that he had going in his area. And so finally it's 2 or 3 in the afternoon. We're basically exhausted with the things to do. And I mentioned to him finally, well, you know, this morning, you know, I kind of had this feeling about 207th place. And I don't know if you know the grids up in Seattle. I think it was Northeast, you know, the Northeast grid. So NE, you know, so whatever that street was. And so about the third house, so we, you know, he says, well, let's give it a try. And the third house we knock on, I knock on the door of the lady who I had talked to for a half hour on the plane ride to Seattle.
Oh, so, wow.
So it was like, holy crap, I better pay attention from now on. This stuff works, you know. So I remember, you know, how you write your mission president a letter every week. And then, you know, he takes excerpts from those things and puts them in the mission newsletter and all that stuff. And so that little story got told in the mission field. But it was really a little thing to me of, you know, and so the lady, you know, her jaw just dropped when she sees me at her door. And my jaw, as soon as it took me like 15 seconds to remember, you know, how I knew her. And she goes, you're kidding. How did you find me? You know, and stuff like that. And I go, well, we just, you know, felt like this was the place to go. This isn't my area. And, you know, we placed a Book of Mormon with her and she wasn't interested in hearing the gospel. So,
But it was for me, for sure.
Yeah. So other, you know, mission experiences that really became, you know, key to me had to do a lot with, you know, really learning to embrace people who were not like me. You know, people with, you know, less education, who's, you know, who maybe don't seem to have as bright a prospects and whatnot. I remember, you know, being just constantly taught by companions that, you know, your way isn't the only way to do things. And, you know, the elder from Beaver, Utah, who, you know, isn't the big deep thinker from you, still has a lot of things to teach me. So I remember, you know, learning a lot of really good lessons on my mission that way. As far as a spiritual experience goes, I would say this is the first of two like this that I had. And I remember praying one morning in Mount Vernon, Washington. I don't know, this is a personal study time or, you know, whatever it was. And somehow or other, just completely going over all the different investigators that we were working with in my mind, you know, just that real careful, you know, so-and-so and his struggle with this and, you know, she with her struggle with that and help us, you know, convince this person, you know, this or that, just one of those really careful, close inventories. And what happened to me at that moment was like every separation I felt from these people or from any person on the planet sort of went away. And I just, you know, my language back then was I felt exactly how God felt about these people, you know, that there was, that they were just, you know, perfect, wonderful, amazing beings, you know, who, you know, are, you know, pure good, and that God sees them only as, you know, fully whole, and all the different things. And I just, like, wow, just, I got a peek that felt like it lasted for 20 or 30 minutes of, you know, expansive view of people and, you know, who they really are deep down. And then, of course, the power of that was just incredible. I mean, for the next several weeks, I was still feeling the effects of seeing people, you know, through this sort of light, this lens of light and you know, hopefulness and whatnot. So that was, you know, that was a pretty amazing experience there. And then I think I shared one in my closing remarks at Sunstone that was pretty powerful. I don't know if you want me to go into that or whatnot, but
yeah, I think most people have not heard it.
Okay. Right. I mentioned before that one of the, you know, the Sons of Mosiah and Alma the Younger were important to me. Well, there was a moment in my scripture study before my mission where the verse, Mosiah 28 verse 3, just like stopped me in my tracks. Cause here I'm feeling like this kinship with these guys. And all of a sudden there's this verse that says, now they were desirous that they should, you know, take the gospel into the Lamanites, you know, their enemies and da, 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 da. For they could not bear the thought that any soul should perish. Yea, even the thought that any soul should endure endless torment, etc., did cause them to quake and tremble. And I remember, you know, thinking about this prior to my mission. I'm saying, wow, I can't even imagine feeling that. You know, I can't even imagine feeling love so much that you would do anything, you know, to bring a message of salvation and the joy and the turnaround in your own life, and that was available to them. You know, to feel it that much for anybody, it just blew me away. And so Mosiah 28:3 kind of became, you know, one of the, you know, scriptures that I talked about as I, you know, did my farewell. I remember somehow bearing my testimony in the MTC and, you know, bringing up Mosiah 23, and I'm sure my early zone conferences and whatnot, everyone was, you know, that was just sort of a theme in my mission. But, you know, like everything else, you have other experiences and other scriptures that kind of come up from time to time. But anyway, about the about 10 days before the end of my mission, I am tracting with my companion, and we go to the house of a woman who basically was nice to us, but she, you know, said she wasn't interested in hearing the gospel. And as we left the house and kind of made our way off the driveway and onto the sidewalk and a few steps down it, I got like whacked with such a feeling of love for her and, you know, sense of the importance of the message. And I can't use it, but I seriously, you know, it'll sound stupid, I quaked and I trembled. You know what I mean? I somehow or other, I stepped into that space of feeling the way that, you know, the Book of Mormon described the Sons of Mosiah's feeling of loving people enough that you just, your heart just ached, you know, to, you know, have them see what you could see and the beauty of it. But anyway, my companion's like, what is going on with you, dude? You know, and I just like freaking, and I can hardly talk. And again, that feeling just from that moment throughout the rest of my mission was just constant with me.
Yeah, and it wasn't because she was cute.
No, I'm sure she was middle-aged. Yeah, no, you know, so to me, it's like, okay, so I had another glimpse. This wasn't, and I still had, you know, other powerful glimpses in my life, more of the deep connection of everybody that are profound experiences that anchor me. But there on my mission, I felt like it was, I mean, I interpreted it then, and I interpret it still now, I have to admit, as like, whether it's God or not, somehow or other, you know, I was, you know, kind of being shown that I had developed us, you know, into the kind of person that could love others that much. You know what I mean? So it was like a little, I don't know if it's a pat on the back or it was just like a, an attaboy, or I'm not even saying it the way I want to, but it was just one of those things where somehow or other, even I'd forgotten Isaiah 28:3, God hadn't, the universe hadn't, or just somehow or other through 18 months of service. I mean, I was a very good missionary. I mean, I was not a rule breaker or any of those kinds of things. Not that I even think that that's that important now, but somehow or other I'd become that kind of person that could love enough, you know, to feel that way. So,
and do you feel embarrassed to talk like that? Because I know that you would probably think it makes me sound kind of goofy or like I'm bragging or.
I'm not embarrassed by it.
Pretty comfortable.
I know that the experience happened. And again, because I felt the effects for weeks and weeks afterwards where, you know, I was in a new, you know, kind of relationship with everybody in the world around me. All of a sudden I loved them all, you know, and you could do anything to me or something like that. And I'd be able to love you back, you know, for that time. And of course that slowly fades as, you know, regular life enters in or whatnot, or as you kind of step away from the experience. So I'm not embarrassed to say that absolutely something like that happened. Where I hesitate, and this is, I guess, would come out in parts of our podcast as we keep going, you know, I don't know exactly how to interpret those things anymore. You know, back then it was God, you know, sent me an attaboy. You know, he remembered even if I had forgotten Isaiah 28:3, you know, I was able to get that experience. Whereas now I don't know that anybody who faithfully, you know, was outward focused for that extended period of time, you know, who was working hard only to better people's lives, you know, I don't know that anybody wouldn't have that experience. I don't know that you need a God pushing a button saying, let's now bless Dan with this experience. I think in some ways that you put yourself in a certain position and an attitude towards people around you that anybody might qualify, you know, for just having that thin line between you and other people get blurred.
And how much do you feel that still, you know, hanging around? How much do you feel like you're still influenced and affected by those experiences? Like, do you feel like some things rubbed off is what I'm asking?
I mean, they're very stark memories for me. They're touchstones in my life where I know that I touched something, you know,
okay,
different than ordinary life. I've had other experiences since then. So I can't really say that it was my mission experiences only that have made me feel like I'm somehow more than just my body, you know,
right,
or that other people are more than just, you know, they aren't important or aren't part of me. And that, I don't know. My love for other people have come in other experiences.
Sure. Since. Sure. Yeah. Okay, cool. So amazing mission experiences.
Yeah, I had a great mission with a fantastic mission president. And, you know, I just couldn't have done anything better. And I guess somehow or other while I'm out there, I reapply for BYU and they admit me again. And so I start there and I immediately get a job at the MTC teaching missionaries. And I ended up teaching for 2.5 years senior couple missionaries and senior sisters who were, you know, going on missions. And just had an amazing 2.5 years.
All right. So you're teaching the MTC. You're married.
Yeah, we get married. And so at the MTC, one of the things that maybe people don't know is if CES, you know, Church Education System, recruits the heck out of MTC teachers. You know, like, come be a seminary teacher. Come, you know, join CES. And here's the classes you should take. And so you take this first intro to what it's like to, you know, be a CES thing. And I'm gung-ho, and I'm sure that this is what I want to do. You take the next one, and you do, you know, 3 days of student teaching along with, you know, the class learning. And, you know, you observe at seminaries and whatnot for a while. And I go through that, you know, well. And I'm just sure that I'm going to be a CES person. And then I, you know, the next level is to do some sustained student teaching, and they, you know, come evaluate you from time to time. And the teacher who's class you're, you know, basically stepping into for that 1 hour every day for a few weeks, you know, is looking over things. And I did well on all the evaluations, and it was looking towards the point where they wanted to hire me. And I just had to be honest with myself. I did not enjoy my student teaching. I didn't go to seminary. I mentioned that I kind of started partying when I was a junior in high school. It doesn't mean that I was going to early morning, 6 a.m., you know, seminary in San Diego, you know, prior to that. So I really, this was my first experience at seminary. I didn't realize how much, I mean, you know, my easy, quick language is how much singing and dancing you have to do, how much, you know, shucking and jiving and, you know, showing movies and playing games and all that stuff, you know, to get the kids to maybe get a good 10 or 15 minutes worth of spiritual lesson in. And, you know, I'm there as this earnest student teacher, and I've got this stuff. Shouldn't the truth entertain these kids enough? You know, kind of thing. And
right.
Anyway, it was just one of those things where I just wasn't relaxed, and I wasn't able to. I think today I could, but at that point in my life, I couldn't relax into the teenage sort of, you know, I'll take it where I can get it kind of attitude, and, you know, and I'll have a lot of fun with the kids there. So in my conversation with Rand Packer, who was the, you know, head of, you know, CES recruiting and kind of this whole thing, I just told him, you know, I just don't think teaching teenagers is for me. And he says, brother, I totally understand that. He says, you know, it's one of those things you're either born to or not. You can't force it. If you don't have an ease with this, don't. So, you know, don't feel like you failed. And I don't know if it was him or just somehow or other, I got it in my mind that I, you know, could maybe still teach institute, you know, because that's college kids. You know, you don't have to sing and dance for that. And so somehow or other, either from an indication from him that some people go directly into institute or whatnot, I just at least began to shift my idea that that might be the case. But at this time, I'm now a senior at BYU, and I'm thinking about what I want to do. And I knew that I had majored in philosophy, and I was taking every class that I could that was related to world religions, you know, to the philosophy of Judaism. I just knew I was interested in religion in general. And so I decided to look into graduate programs in religion. I ended up, you know, going to Arizona State. In the back of my mind, it's, you know, maybe I can step into seminary institute, you know, here through, you know, qualifying with a master's degree or something. You know, I'll be on a campus or whatever I do, and they'll invite me to teach a class or two, and then next thing you know, they want me full time or something. You know, that was in the back of my mind, but basically I decided to follow my bliss and keep studying what I was interested in and hopefully turn into a college professor and perhaps an institute teacher. So that's what led me to Arizona State and my master's program.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, S-K-Y-E, pixton.com. Thank you.